can you grab the door?
Thank you.
All right. We are going to try to finish up Daniel 11 today. Next week is the tech talk, and then the race to the finish in February to do Daniel 12 as well as 1 through 7. So, we kind of started out in Daniel 11 last week, and I gave you kind of the history of what this is all about. And I didn't draw the map again, but I put up here the various rulers that we're going to talk about. And these are the Ptolemies, who are in Egypt, and these are the Seleucids, who are up in Antioch of Syria and cover most of the rest of what was the Grecian Empire of Alexander the Great after he has died. And we talked last week, just started out in this. And basically what you've got, and I'm just going to give you this real briefly, and then we'll delve into it a little bit more. So what you have in Daniel 11, so verse 2 deals with Persia, the ruling power at the time of Daniel, and then at the later part of Daniel. And then verse 3 and 4 deal with Alexander the Great. And one thing we didn't talk about last time when we talked about that is interesting in verse 4. Now again, we believe this is written sometime in the 500 BCs, but it's talking about things that's going to take place in the 300 to 100 BC time frame. And it's interesting, in verse 4, it talks about how when Alexander the Great, after he's built this great dominion, he's doing what he wills, his kingdom will be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled. And we talked last time how his only legitimate heir wasn't even born at the time he dies, and never becomes king of his rule. So again, not according to his posterity, so doesn't pass that way, and not according to his authority. The authority says is that he passed his signet ring onto Picardus. But Picardus has quickly run out of town and does not take over either. So this shows you the amount of detail we're going to get into, that 200 years before or 400 years before it happens, God is saying this is what's going to happen, and it's pretty amazing how well it tracks with what the actual history was. Now, again, just a quick overview of the chapter. 5 through 9 is talking about the king of the south, which is the Ptolemies, and they're going against the king of the north, the Seleucids, and kind of talks about the time when they are strong, and basically they're kind of, they seem to be winning in the various wars between these two, and they are the ones that have control over Judah, Jerusalem, Israel, and they are the ones until 198 BC. And in 198 BC, the Seleucids take over, and so then in verses 10 through 19, whereas 5 through 9 were the south attacking the north, now 10 through 19 we got the north attacking the south, so the Seleucids going after the Ptolemies, and then in basically verses 20, 21, and here's where we'll get into an issue, but 21, either through the end of the chapter or at least to verse 35, is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, the last great ruler of the Seleucid Empire.
So 20
is one verse about his king between two of them. It's about this Seleucus here. But 21 to the end of the chapter is about Antiochus Epiphanes, or 21 through 35. And we'll talk about why some people break it there. So let's go back and we'll pick up. We read a good portion of this last time, although we didn't finish the reading, but we'll pick up and kind of just hit the high points. And again, I think the key things to remember, just keep these in the back of your head and I think you'll be great. One, remember this is part of the message that the representative of God is providing to Daniel as a way to tell him what's going to happen in the future that will impact the nation of Israel. So this is part of the section dealing with 7 through 12 are dealing with visions that are really important for the nation of Israel as God's people, and how the world and what's going on in the world will impact God's people. But ultimately, remember, this is about a spiritual battle going on. And the spiritual battle is God's in control. And one of the ways we see that God's in control in this section is how much of the detail is correct 200 to 400 years ahead of time. So much so that it's why liberal scholars try to maintain Daniel is written in 164 BC after it's all taken place, because chapter 11 is so detailed and gets it pretty spot on. I mean, there are some places where it's, and this is where we have to be careful, the devil's in the details, and I'm not going to get into every little detail, and so this is referencing this specific battle. And I will in certain places say best thought is it is applying to this battle. But by and large, most of the detail, to the extent it can be tied down, ties very, very close to history. Yet it's written 200 to 400 years before it ever happens, which shows you how much God is in control and shows you this is what the purpose is to remind them, even though, you know, there's a part of them thinking, they're thinking that it's going to be, hey, we've just been told we're going back. We're being let go. We can go back to Jerusalem. We can rebuild the city. And it's going to be wonderful and it's going to be hunky-dory. That's an official technical term. But the reality is, even in their time, it's not hunky-dory. They run into problems. But he's saying it's not going to be perfect even into your future. And there's going to be new problems that arise, and new problems in maybe in ways you've not really had to face them before. And so that's what Daniel 11 is about. So if you can keep that in your mind, then maybe we won't get bogged down in the details. I'll be happy to tell you what I know or what I've read. But hopefully all of that helps you keep Daniel 11 in a good focus. So, okay. So, let's look at 5 through 9 first, where we got the south versus the north. And again, remember, although it keeps talking about the king of the south and the king of the north, this isn't one individual. It's talking about a group of kings versus a group of kings. And the south is Egypt, and the north is the Seleucids. It talks about, starts out that the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. And so, again, this starts out with the reign of Ptolemy I, as the first one in this reign of the various Ptolemies. And where it gets interesting is starting in verse 6. And we moved on to the second one, Philadelphus. And what's interesting is it says that, let's read this here. After some years, they shall make an alliance. And making alliance, he's talking about the kings of Ptolemy and the kings of Seleucid. That they make it, they've had several wars, and in fact, there is a peace agreement in 253 BC at the end of the Second Syrian War. And it says in this verse, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. So basically, not unusual. Anybody who knows anything about history, we can talk about in Europe how many times that you have somebody marrying somebody else to consolidate and maybe have peace between two kingdoms and try to bring the end to a various war. That's not an untypical thing to happen. It's also a way to try to take over, you know. So marry your daughter off to the king of another place, marry your son off to the daughter of another place, and you get a foothold in, and you're able to maybe control that location, even though technically they're still under that group of kings. And so this says this is going to happen, but the problem is it's not going to endure. It's not going to be well for the woman who's given as the queen. It's not going to be well to her child. It's not going to be well to anybody who supports her. So what happens in real life? Well, just so happens that so Ptolemy II gives his daughter, and her name is Berenice. And you can call her Bernice if you want to, but it's really Berenice. He gives his daughter Berenice to, make sure I get this right, Antiochus II to be his wife. Now, part of the problem is Antiochus II already has a wife. His name is Laodice. And that doesn't work out well, not surprisingly. So for a little while to try to have this peace, he takes on his daughter as his wife. But at some point, he goes back to his first wife. And even though actually he divorced her in order to marry Berenice, he divorced Laodice. But the alliance ends in a fiasco because Antiochus returns to his first wife, and after he dies, what happens? Laodice has Berenice killed and has the son who was born to Berenice and Antiochus killed. Why? So Laodice's son can be the king. And so, but then in verse 7 it says, and from a branch from her roots one shall arise in his place. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal with them and shall prevail. He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold. And for some years he shall refrain from attacking the north, king of the north. Then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. So, again, so what happens in real life? So, Berenice's brother, who is, make sure I get this right, Ptolemy, I'm going to butcher how you pronounce this, Euergetes, I don't know if that's a Jetes or Gutes. This is the brother of Berenice. Well, he comes to avenge his sister and comes and defeats the Seleucids and takes away a lot of their spoils and stuff from them. But he does kind of deal with Seleucus II, who happens to be Laodice's son. And they cut a deal, and there is a peace treaty for a while. And mainly, the reason for that is because he's having problems back in Egypt. He's got to go back and deal with problems in Egypt. But again, so here you go. You know, this is taking place in like the 250s, 230s range. And Daniel's saying this is what's going to happen in the 530s, 539, 536 range. And so 300 years before it happens, he says, there's going to be this alliance that has to do with the daughter of the king of the south, with the king of the north, but it's not going to work out. And the king of the south is going to go back, and because it doesn't work out, it's going to go and attack, and it's going to prevail. It's exactly what happened. Okay. And then when it talks about in verse 9, the latter shall come into the realm of the king of south, but shall return to his own land. There is evidence that Seleucus tries to go and exact his own revenge, but does not prevail and goes back. And again, there it's a tentative peace, because there's always wars between the two. Because basically, once Alexander the Great dies, it's really a fight between the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids up in Antioch. Greece doesn't play a part at all, by and large. And so then, verses 10 through 19, we now have the north starting to prevail, and it starts in the time of Antiochus the Third, Antiochus the Great, Antiochus Magnus, so Magnus means great. So this is the third guy. And and the Ptolemies are now in their downtrend. They're no longer, they kind of, this time under the third was really their best time. And it now starts to switch, the playing field starts to aim more towards the north taking over, and that's what ends up happening. And so verses 10 through 19, his sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overflow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight against the king of the north, and he shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. And when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. For the king of the north shall again raise a multitude greater than the first, and after some years he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. So, here we have Antiochus, and he's up against the Ptolemy the fourth one, the fourth Ptolemy king. And again, I certainly didn't have a feel. I certainly think the Romans, I think of them as having very, very large armies. But I don't know that I always think of the Egyptians, and who's ever heard of the Seleucids. I just don't think of, but it says they're going to be big armies. Well, it just so happens, in 217 BC, when these two armies go up against one another, we actually have knowledge of how many people were involved. So, the Ptolemy IV, here, this is pretty amazing. 70,000 infantry, 5,000 cavalry, and 73 elephants. And again, they have elephants because the Greek Empire goes all the way over to Egypt. Well, all the way down to Egypt, and maybe they get them from African elephants. But it's more likely it goes all the way over to India. And so they're probably Indian elephants. But wherever they got the elephants, they have elephants. I mean, just
tanks.
Tanks, yes. And Antiochus III, he has 62,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, and 102 elephants. And so in this battle, actually, amazingly, Ptolemy wins. There's 10,000 of the infantry are killed. So it's not a minor battle. It's a fairly significant battle. Ptolemy wins, and then, but 17 years later, they battle again. And this time, Antiochus defeats. By now we have a different one. We're now down to Epiphanes on the Ptolemy side. And at this time we have a complete victory. They annihilate the Ptolemy army, and the Ptolemies never recover. Which explains, here we're down in this time frame with Epiphanes, and we're down here at 200 BC, and by 190 BC we can say clearly Israel is now no longer, up to this point, Israel's really been part of the protectorate of the Ptolemies. Now Israel is part of the protectorate of the Seleucids. Now, it's interesting because verse 14, notice, in those times many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violent among your own people. So some of the Jews take part in this war between the north and the south. It says, then the king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city. And this is in 198 BC, we believe. And the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. But he who comes against him shall do as he wills, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his hand. He shall set his face to come with the strength of his whole kingdom, and he shall bring terms of an agreement and perform them. Now, before we get into the terms of the agreement, I just want to point out a couple of things you're going to see throughout this section. So one, back in verse 10, notice that this is not the first time or the last time that it says, shall keep coming and overflow and pass through. Who do you think they're passing through? Why do you think that reference to passing through anything? Right, it's passing through Israel. As we talked before, you've got, if I were to draw the map, you've got Syria up here, and Antioch up here close to the border with what's now modern-day Turkey. You've got Egypt down here. If they're going to fight, they're going to meet somewhere between Egypt and Antioch. Well, what's between Egypt and Antioch? Israel. And so the references to passing through just talks, and it's in context of like a flood, is the words that are overflow and coming through and passing through. Another thing to note in verse 16 is it talks about he shall stand in the glorious land. What's the glorious land?
The promised land,
Israel. I mean, that's just a phrase that Daniel uses to describe where his people are. And so again, if you see that throughout here, you're going to notice it keeps reminding Daniel, I'm not just talking about some battles between world leaders that to you and me are meaningless because we haven't even heard of these people. To the Israelites, it's very meaningful because it keeps happening through their land. And so it's not going to be fun. Yes, you're going back. Yes, you will be restored. Yes, a remnant is going back to Israel in 539 BC, but it's not going to be a perfect situation, just like it never was, because Israel is always between very powerful nations, and they're always going to be passing through Israel to get to their next conquest. Okay? Now, again, it's interesting how man-made plans frequently show up over and over again, and most of the time don't work. And so we already talked about how the king of the south sends his daughter to the King of the North as a way to try to consolidate the two kingdoms, because nothing means consolidation like marriage. And what's about to happen? The King of the North is going to try to do the same thing. And so it says, as part of the terms of the agreement between these teams to settle the war, he says, he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom. Oh, interesting. It's not to consolidate. I'm going to put in an insider who's going to help me take over, because although Antiochus, you know, that they are able to go down and take a lot of Egypt, they are never able to take all of Egypt. They never capture Alexandria. And so, again, a way to try to capture the capital city is to get in tight with the royal family who's in the capital city. So I'm going to give my daughter to the king, and that'll consolidate this. And although maybe the current king will be a puppet king, my daughter's lineage will ultimately be the ruler of this, and therefore have be obedient to me as the overall leader. But again, what happens in real history? Well, Antiochus the Third Magnus, he actually gives his daughter, and her name is Cleopatra, which is interesting because I think of Cleopatra as an Egyptian name, but evidently it's not. And this is the first Cleopatra, and evidently, but obviously gets introduced to Egypt, and we have the later, much more famous Cleopatra. But he gives his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy V. And the problem is she ends up siding with her husband. I don't know why. So it doesn't work out. So he doesn't really get what he wants. So in either case, they both thought, you know, I'm going to give my daughter, and I'm going to give my daughter, and in either case does it work out. And the Bible says it's not going to work out. And yet, that's 300 years before it happens. Okay. Afterwards he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them. Now the coastlands is anywhere along the Mediterranean and includes the Greece and the Grecian islands, and Antiochus does go over and actually takes part of Greece. But a commander shall put an end to this insolence. Well, it just so happens all of a sudden Rome now shows up on the scene. And Rome is the commander that's being referenced. And Rome, there's a four-year war in mainland Greece in the 192 BC time frame. And Rome, with 30,000 troops, beats Antiochus' troops of 72,000, and 53,000 of Antiochus' men are killed. And so that definitely puts an end to Antiochus's trying to go towards the west and trying to take over the west. And so it says in verse 19, then he shall turn his face back toward the fortresses of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. And he actually is killed. And again, this is another common theme. He's killed while pillaging a temple of Bel or Baal in Persia in 187 BC. So, verse 20, then shall arise in his place one who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be broken, neither in anger nor in battle. So, this is Seleucus the Fourth. Notice he's not in control for very long, and the reason he's not in control for very long is because he's assassinated. So again, not in battle, whereas some of these people lost their lives in battle, which is an honorable way to die if you're a king, He is assassinated by his prime minister, Heliodorus. And Heliodorus tries to take over because, again, this is the whole interesting thing of how this works. So Antiochus Epiphanes, who we're getting ready to talk about, is actually the son of, is a son of Antiochus Magnus. But he wasn't the one in line for being named king. Seleucus was, and Seleucus has two sons who should be king in his place when he is assassinated. The problem is, so this is an interesting dilemma. So because they have lost to Rome, part of the treaty that they, when they lost to Rome, they are the king's son, so his oldest son, Demetrius, he has to go to Rome and be a prisoner in Rome. And his youngest son, who's also called Antiochus, which always helps when you got this name keep popping up. But his younger son is not old enough to be king. And so you got this Heliodorus, who's the prime minister, who's going to rule, you know, be the regent in place or help the son until the son grows up. Well, so now we have Antiochus Epiphanes, the last of the Seleucid kings, and he decides, you know, Heliodorus shouldn't be in control, and oh, by the way, neither should Antiochus, and Demetrius is out of the way because he's in prison in Rome. So he comes and he takes over, and in effect kills his, kills Heliodorus, kills Antiochus, and takes over. And again, interesting, verse 21. In his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He wasn't the rightful leader. He wasn't the one who was supposed to be in charge. And Daniel says that. Let's see, what are we in now? We're in the 170s, so we're almost, let me do the math for me, 350 years, basically. Daniel, talking in 539, is able to say, this guy who's going to be a real pain to y'all is going to become king, not because he's the rightful king, but because he's actually going to assassinate the rightful king and take over. And so let's read a little bit about Antiochus and about what a wonderful guy he is. And again, as prophecy, this is what this is saying. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand. For plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail. For the end is yet to be at the time appointed. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant. And he shall work his will and return to his own land. Okay, so um, let's go back and kind of see how this fits in with what happens in history and real, and 300 years after it's been prophesied. So back in verse 22, anybody have an idea who the Prince of the Covenant is, or what that might be referring to, or why the covenant would at least be brought up?
I mean, we know that they took over the religious services. They Hellenized or whatever they call it.
Right. Okay. So the covenant here is to Daniel, to the people he's writing to, what is the covenant got to be?
The temple.
I mean, it's God's covenant with his people, the Old Testament. It's the old law. That's what's being referenced. And the Prince of the Covenant, the thing that best fits this from history, is the high priest. And just so happens, Onias III is in 175 BC is removed as high priest by Antiochus and his people. And by 171, Onias III is assassinated. And so we start to see, and this is something that's a little bit unusual, not completely, it's kind of one of the themes of Daniel, but this theme that, I mean, so Assyria and Babylon had been basically forces God uses to punish his people because they had left him. Antiochus is not being used by God to punish his people. Antiochus starts kind of a new thing, which is, because up to this time, by and large, most of what happens is that when a power comes through and takes over, they don't generally try to impose their culture on the power. They may do things such as take away the most important people, as happened with the Babylonian captivity. They may, in their, they may be, for example, Babylon destroys the temple and takes all the good stuff away from the temple. But it wasn't particularly an attack on God, per se. It was really more about their power, and they needed whatever money they could find as a way to support their kingdom. Starting with Antiochus, we're starting to get into an area and a time frame where the Jews are going to be attacked just because they're Jews. We don't know why Antiochus does this. We have some indication, but we don't know for sure why he does. But he is the first one, potentially many, because clearly, like the Romans, later on, they persecute the Christians because they're Christians, and because they view that they need to do that because somehow Christianity is an affront to their view of the world and their view of religion. And so we're starting to get into a time frame when people start terrorizing God's people because they are God's people. And so in one sense, this is a whole new animal. Now, to some extent, we've already seen it a little bit. That's part of the theme of Daniel, because again, although we haven't talked about, we all know what happens in the first few chapters. So, for example, what does Nebuchadnezzar do that's viewed as an attack upon the God of heaven?
Builds an image.
The what?
Builds an image that everybody bows down.
Builds an image everybody's supposed to bow down to. What else happens in the first few chapters where it's viewed as an attack upon?
No prayer.
So Daniel's thrown into the lion's den because he's not supposed to pray to God, because he's only supposed to make petitions to the king. So this is a common theme throughout Daniel. This is just saying it's not going to get any better. It's actually going to get worse. And this, in the name of Antiochus Epiphanes, and interesting, I'll bring this up right now. Anybody know what Epiphanes means? Let me take a step back. What is, we all have heard of Epiphany, right? It has something to do with the birth of Christ. At least our friends may say that. What does Epiphany mean?
A revelation.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if I remember right, the actual day of Epiphany that people celebrate is the day that the three wise men supposedly came and worshiped Christ. But the word Epiphany means God made manifest. Interesting. Antiochus is one of the first. Now again, we know that the Egyptian pharaohs, a lot of them had names that were tied to their various gods. But he's saying he is God made manifest. And so his very nature is to attack anything that doesn't support him as God. And that's what's happening in this part of chapter 11. In this part we just read, he invades Egypt in around 170 BC. And then verse 29, we'll read down to 35. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the holy covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery, and some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. So, his second attack on Egypt to try to take over all of Egypt. One, he hears Egypt's going to attack him, so he gets a head start and decides to attack them. The problem is, it says ships of Kittim. As anybody knows, they've got a footnote that says what Kittim is, where it is. Cyprus. All right, Cyprus is what Kittim is. And what is Cyprus? It's an island in the middle of the Mediterranean that happens to be west of there. And it happens to be representative of Rome. And it just so happens, interestingly enough, as Antiochus is marching to take over completely and take over Alexandria and all of Egypt, he's met by a Roman army. And the Roman army says, "We want to know what you're planning on doing. What are you doing down here? What are you?" And he says, "Well, I was coming to take Egypt." And the Roman leader says, "Well, we can't let that happen." He says, "So what are you going to tell me you're going to do now?" He says, "Well, I'll need to go back and talk with my council and see what we're going to do." And the Roman leader, what he does is he actually draws a circle around in the sand around Antiochus Epiphanes and says, "You will not leave this circle till you tell me something that is acceptable for me to go back and tell Rome as to what you're going to do." So basically, because he sees he's outmanned and outfoxed and not going to be able to leave, he says, "Fine, I will not attack," and he leaves. And some believe because of his embarrassment at the hands of Rome and is not able to get his way in Egypt. And as he's heading back to his home, where does he go through again? He goes through Israel, he goes through Jerusalem, and he takes it out on Jerusalem. Now it's also possible, again, some of the things that have happened in Jerusalem, he has replaced again the high priest with one of his own. And while he was down in Egypt, word had gotten out to Jerusalem that he'd been killed in Egypt. And so the previous high priest takes back over and kicks out Antiochus's high priest. And when Antiochus comes back through and finds this out, he decides to level Jerusalem in order to prove to Jerusalem who's in charge. But either way, it's clear he starts to really take over and really exert his authority as a god. And he decimates the temple. He, according to various historians of the time, which amazingly we have some from them, he sacrifices pigs on the altar. He builds a new altar first, and then he sacrifices pigs on the altar and supposedly makes anybody who wants to be beholden to him eat the pigs that he has sacrificed on the altar. He builds a fortress called Acra there in Jerusalem to watch to see what's happening. And he basically has all of the Hellenistic Jews who basically are go-along, get-along people. They're fine with him. It's the Jews who believe that God does not want them bowing down to Antiochus that are a problem for him. And then this leads to, you have in 166 to 164, you have the Maccabean Rebellion, which you may or may not have heard of. That's where Hanukkah comes from. And so as a part of that rebellion, amazingly, they stand up to him, but it is not easy. It is not a wonderful time, and that's why you've got this mention of the sword and the flame and by captivity and plunder that the wise will stand up to him. And then verse 36, basically on through the end, talks about him. Now here's, let me just plant this seed and we'll finish it 2 weeks from now as we get into chapter 12. But a lot of people, because there's some things in 36 on that we don't yet have evidence that happened in history. And so it's weird because liberals try to view this is when the prophecy takes place. And the problem is, if it's applying to Antiochus, we can't absolutely apply it to Antiochus, so it's not good prophecy. So if we're not supposed to listen to Daniel about bad prophecy as we're learning, as we talk about the prophets, then why should we have talked to him about anything before this? But they don't have a problem with that for some reason. I guess because they don't believe in prophecy, so it doesn't matter whether you have bad prophecy or good prophecy. The history was good up to this point. But there are some ways to discuss whether this might not be correct, and we'll talk about that in 2 weeks. But a lot of people try to view that this is not, from 35 on, is not about Antiochus. It's about future times, whether that's the Romans, whether it's the end of the world. And so that's where we'll pick up 2 weeks from now. Thank y'all. Sorry for the boring, long history lesson.
A lot easier to read the gospel, isn't it?
Yes.